You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and welcoming you on March the 19th to Mallorca and the podcast, formerly known as the Cycling Podcast. We're about to rechristen it Through the Keyhole. My name is Daniel Freeber. I am, well, the host of this episode, whatever it is. I say we're going to rechristen it because last week we had a house visit. Went to see Larry Warbass on the Côte d'Azur. Today I've got another co-host, hopefully, waiting for us. Bon dia. Is that Rob Hatch? Rob Hatch. It's the Cycling Podcast. Can you open for us, please?
Give me a minute.
He's coming, I think. I said I'm in Mallorca, I'm in Sóller, in Mallorca specifically, and we are at home with Rob Hatch. Here he is.
Hi, Sam, what are you doing here?
Now then.
Welcome.
How is it going?
Very well, thank you. Come in.
This is steep, isn't it?
Oh, it's the first cap.
Is this the steepest climb in Mallorca?
It is especial, I think. I don't know the gradients, but they're pretty standard.
The Sacalobra of Sóller. Rob, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just got back from...
I can see your suitcase. Where have you been?
Where have I been? I've been in London, pretending to be in Sanremo. I've been in Koblenz with Mathieu van der Poel at Canyon.
More about that later.
Yeah, loads going on. I've been an exciting couple of weeks.
Do you know what? Yesterday, I was in four countries, if we can consider Monaco a country. I started the day in Sanremo in Italy. Got the train. Snag my kitchen door. I started in Sanremo. I went through Monaco on the train into France. Mm. Flew Barcelona, then here.
Amazing.
It's Rob,
amazing what you can do nowadays, isn't it?
Rob, I'm going to pretend I've not been here before.
Make yourself at home.
Yeah, I will, don't worry. Rob, straight out onto the balcony. That's where we're going to record today's podcast. But I wanted to go straight out onto the balcony because this is the highlight of the property, really, isn't it? Imagine you're in
a... Lives in a house like this. Imagine, yes, Lloyd.
Imagine you're an estate agent now. And, as I said, this is the big ticket item in the house. And the view, what a spectacular location you live in Sóller. So we're on the, this is always referred to as the north of Mallorca. I don't really consider it the north, it's the west, isn't it? We're very close, we're a couple of kilometres from the Mediterranean itself, at the foot of the Tramontana Mountains. Mm-hmm. But describe this beautiful view.
Well, I've got next door's wonderful garden, which actually, if you don't look, come close enough to the balcony, it looks like mine, and it looks like I live in an absolute beauty of a property. But
it looks like you've got a gorgeous swimming pool surrounded by citrus trees as well.
Not the case, unfortunately. The best we can do is a 3-metre-square balcony, but it's lovely. We can see the Serra del Fabia, which is part of the Tramontana Mountains, the big TV antennas that give the television to all the Balearic Islands up there, the Coy de Sóller. Many of you know from probably having ridden it, or if not in the Mallorca Challenge races. And plenty of nice old stone houses. You know, there's a bit of scruffy stuff around as well, as there always is anyway. It's a nice mix, isn't it? It's lovely.
Oh, don't under-egg it, Rob. It's palatial, and it's in a very opulent setting. Rob, did you mention the TV area up there?
Yeah.
You did. You are, of course, the voice of cycling.
That's a great link, that.
Exactly. I'll cling to whatever I can find. You are, of course, the voice, a voice of cycling on television, that's on amazing. Eurosport. You've been commentating this week on races in the last week. We're going to talk about the racing we've seen over the last week. We're going to talk about the racing we're going to see over the next couple of weeks. You and I are going to be side by side for this podcast. And we're going to have a third guest, or a third host. We're welcoming in just a second, but first, I'm not going to say put the kettle on. Can you go and put the coffee machine on?
I'm doing it now.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast, team car, at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the virtual private network to keep you safe and secure when you are online. That's the primary reason that I'm a NordVPN customer anyway, but there are plenty of other benefits. You can go to nordvpn.com/TCP, TCP for the Cycling Podcast, of course, and get yourself an exclusive NordVPN deal. It's also risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, so that's nordvpn.com/TCP. Now, I signed up for NordVPN in the first place before they started advertising in the Cycling Podcast, and the reason I did it was to ensure that all of my connections were safe and secure whenever I was online. For example, this morning I was working in a cafe using the Wi-Fi there, and I activated my NordVPN subscription just in one simple click, just to know that my data was going to be safe and secure from anyone who might be looking over my shoulder digitally, so to speak. You can use your NordVPN account on up to 6 devices, so I actually use it even when I'm at home working in my office. So I've got my laptop, my phone, iPad, and even our TV is protected by NordVPN. Lots of other benefits too. You can, if you're away on holiday, you can log on to the internet as if you're at home and enjoy all of your streaming services uninterrupted, sort of getting around the geo block if you want to. And also, when you're buying something online, companies, hard to believe, I know, but the price can vary depending on how and when you log on. And if you use your NordVPN, you can avoid so-called price discrimination. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP, sign up, get yourself an exclusive NordVPN deal, and know that it's risk-free, so you can get your money back in 30 days if it turns out it's not for you. We'll put the details in the show notes too.
Well, my co-host, Artisan Barista, has returned with his coffee, not mine. He's got me a nice glass of the world's finest mineral water instead, Vichy Catalan. That's one co-host. We have been joined finally by our other co-host. Unfortunately, he's not with us. Unfortunately for him, he's not with us here in Mallorca, but it is our own Kern Bowman lookalike young Richard Abraham, who is joining us from the UK, I believe.
Hi, Daniel. Hi, Rob.
Hello, hello.
I'm a bit disappointed that, I was saying this before, no orange groves or seaside views or even blue sky, just wall behind you.
We've kept them from you. They're right in front of us.
Yeah, we've got enough of those. Okay. We've got enough of those for all of us. Kern Bowman, of course, double Giro d'Italia stage winner, rides for
Visma Lisa Bike.
We're not even on their leaderboard. The Cycling Podcast is conspicuous for its absence on
apparently
their podcast.
All the British media is absent as well. I think it's only continental European. Somebody told me that the weekend.
We were all ready for
the competition and everything.
Some of us have an EU passport. anyway, Kern Bowman, of course, double Giro d'Italia stage winner, rides for Visma Lisa Bike, looks very like young Richard Abraham. Kern Bowman, Richard, you will excuse me, you will indulge me, because he's very much on my mind, because over the last couple of days I've been catching up on the formerly Jumbo Visma Amazon Prime documentary series, 6 parts, starts in 2022. Very good it is too, very good. These series now, they can be quite formulaic. We're pretty familiar now with the dashboard cam stuff from the team car, the team bus, inside the team bus, the racing footage, and it can be difficult to make them original and compelling, but this one is well worth a watch. I don't know when it's coming out in other territories, Rob, do you know?
No idea. I didn't even know I was on it until you just told me.
I didn't tell you were on it. But you, of course, you assumed you're on it because you're on all those bloody things. yeah, you are on it. You are on it. Anyway, it's very good. It's very good. Richard, how are you otherwise?
Doing all right, thanks. Yeah. Slightly jealous of your Mediterranean tour. Phoning in from a grey England. But doing all right, thank you. Yeah,
just pretend it's beautiful, just pretend, sunshine, okay. And there are palm trees swaying in the wind outside blossom. Your front window.
It's not a lie, actually. There's blossom in the air. The sun is just breaking through the clouds. I can see the beautiful sights of Oxford in front of me. Yeah, all these ancient buildings. Ancient in my case, being from the 1930s. But
any sign of Any sign of Kate Middleton? Anytime I go on to social media, that's all I see. Isn't that the big talking point?
I think the lawyers might.
Is Kate Middleton?
Well, am I allowed to say? Maybe we'll get into some legal hot water.
Let's not get into any legal hot water. I suppose, Richard, at this point, we should crack on with not fake news or speculation, social media speculation about royals, but actual news from the world
real
of cycling.
Facts.
Yes, let's have a news roundup, shall we? And you will deliver that news roundup for us this week.
Yes, well, we're going to have to rattle through it because, lots going on. We'll start last Wednesday with Nokere Corsa, won by who else but Lotta Kopecky. Solo, the last 7K in the women's race, Lorena Wiebes second, her teammate. And then by Tim Melea, who, well, Rob, you were just saying off mic earlier, this was sort of a home race for Tim.
5 kilometres away, I think he lives.
There we go. And I did hear on the commentary as well, I don't think he trains around there very much, but it is sort of his home race. Anyway, he, well, stamped a real kind of mark on that with that sprint up that sort of cobbled drag through Nokere, that's the finish line, beating Jasper Philipsen and Fabio Jakobsen as well. Tim Melea, who was not at San Remo,
do we know why?
Maybe we'll discuss. No, we don't. I don't know why.
Rob, do you know perhaps? Why?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, he wanted to ride Nokere, I'm pretty sure about that, because I think he's won 3 times in a row there now, like I said, home race. And we can only assume, I guess, that Monsieur Alaphilippe was given the sole leadership.
And vindicated that to a certain extent. Didn't mention in Arrivé on Saturday, because we didn't know yet, that he'd had some significant mechanical problems in the last few kilometres, as did Filippo Ganna. Maybe we'll discuss that, or we'll touch on that later.
Mm-hmm. Taking place at the same time, in fact, is the sort of the wandering race of Milano-Torino, taking place this year in the spring, just before Milan-San Remo, and featuring a sort of a final climb and then a sort of fast run into the finish. It was won by Alberto Bettiol, who looked very impressive, who again was up there in San Remo. He went solo for 30K in Milano-Torino something that I think we'll probably see a bit more of. He was wearing a TT helmet for that, so obviously sort of planned, I think, to maybe go it alone. But turned a few heads, I think, that get up, seeing basically TT suit in a road race. We'll move on pretty swiftly to the GP de Nain, which was last Thursday. Classic northern French cobbled roads. It's all the cobbled sectors that make up the start of the cobbles in Paris-Roubaix. Typically kind of filthy, muddy, which had a big say on the outcome of the race, because Chase Group, led by Stefan Kung, came down, which handed the fight for victory to two remaining riders of the breakaway, Yannick Steimler and Cyril Dessalle. It was Steimler, formerly of Quickstep, now of Q36.5, who took that. That's the first win for Q36.5. So quite a big deal for him. Biggest race of his career, biggest race win of his career, and the first one of the season for that team. So
bit controversial, that race, chaps, with the road. The cobbles weren't in great condition, were they? Very muddy. Stefan Kung, I suppose, wasn't too impressed. I think Adam Hansen was very impressed either, the head of the riders' union.
No, he was straight on it, wasn't he, Adam Hansen, with a post on, mm-hmm. on social media asking what on earth the organisers were doing. And yeah, do people know what they're signing up for when they go to Grand Prix de Nain, as they do when they go to Paris-Roubaix? I guess that's up in the air, and certainly maybe younger, newer pros aren't quite as conscious of the history. But yeah, certainly have to commend Adam Hansen for sticking up for the riders, but maybe a question mark in the air there.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, isn't it, sometimes from the images that you get from a race without actually going over to de Nain and having a good look at the cobbles. It's not always easy to come to any sort of firm conclusion. We sort of get into that grey area, don't you, of what, you know, what was that, the first women's Roubaix, when Lizzie Deignan was slipping and sliding all over the place and the cobbles were absolutely filthy. I mean, that was sort of held up as a, you know, it added to her victory, didn't it, and to her exploits, rather than detracted from it. You know, there weren't people saying they shouldn't be racing in that. It was really seen as a good thing.
Yeah, generally speaking, I'm not hashtag team wet Roubaix. This is one of the things I find tedious, not only because it's dangerous. I think I've said this many times before on the podcast, but I like Paris-Roubaix when it's hot, dusty, and you really get a sense of speed and you get a sense of sort of, well, teeth chattering, kind of white knuckle speed in Paris-Roubaix.
They're a lot nicer to commentate on as well, because we actually can see who is who.
Yeah,
I think it may be as well, it depends on you sort of the first kind of romantic image you had of Paris-Roubaix, if there is a Paris-Roubaix that planted a sort of seed in my mind, in my sort of affections for the race, it was the Mappe one in 95, where they clean swept, I always get this wrong, is it 95 or 96, where they clean swept the podium and they were all caked in dust, not mud, at the finish. But that was a very fast Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, I did see a stat one year when they had the Tour de France, had a cobbled stage, and I think April is like it's one of the driest months up there in that part of France, contrary to sort of what you would perhaps assume. Anyway, should we move on to some more racing last week? Friday was the Bredene Kokzijde Classic. That was won by Luca Mazzato of Arkea B&B ahead of Dylan Groenewegen. And then over the weekend, a doubleheader over in West France, Classique Loire Atlantique on Saturday and the Cholet Aglo Tour, both won by Paul Lapeyre of the newly outfitted Decathlon Agir d'Oselle. Lapeyre is now leading the Coupe de France, and that's quite an important competition really for those French teams, even though it's sort of overlooked by the rest of us in the cycling world. Also taking place on Sunday was the Trofeo Alfredo Binda, which was won by Elisa Balsamo of Lidl-Trek, managing to beat Lotta Kopecky in a small group sprint. Third place there was worth noting was Puck Pieterse, just 21, but you know, already a star in the cyclocross world. That's a second third place for Pieterse in the Women's World Tour this year. So perhaps one to watch ahead of the Cobble Classics. And this Monday, so yesterday as we're recording, was the opening stage of the Tour of Catalunya, almost won by Tadej Pogacar, but won in fact by Nick Schultz, Aussie, who is a sort of local to Girona. This was very much a local stage for riders who are based there, taking in that part of the world. I think we'll probably come on to that, won't we, a little bit, chaps, the opening stage there. But just as a heads up for what's coming this week, they go to Valtaire 2000 today, Tuesday, another mountain stage on Wednesday, and again on Saturday, kind of decisive mountain stage will be going to Queralt on Saturday. And then it finishes and concludes on Sunday with the classic Montjuïc circuit race through Barcelona. And I don't know if you saw this story, chaps, the Pope has switched to disc brakes, possibly. A few different outlets picked up on the fact that the Vatican appears to be auctioning a Pinarello, which was given to the Pope by Egan Bernal in 2021 after Bernal won the Giro. It got me thinking about bikes gifted to the Pope. It's not the first, possibly won't be the last. Peter Sagan gave Specialized to the Pope, apparently, in 2018. And
he's definitely
quite famously
had a Colnago. He's definitely had a Colnago.
He's had a gold, well, not just a Colnago, a gold-plated Colnago, which Pope John Paul II got in 1979.
I don't wish to sort of disrespect the venerable figure that is Ernesto Colnago, but Ernesto Colnago, I remember once he produced a coffee table book. I can't remember which anniversary this was celebrating or which birthday. He's over 90. Didn't he recently celebrate his 90th birthday? Anyway, this was 15 or 20 years ago, and I can remember one picture, a very grainy picture in there of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. There were no Colnago bikes in sight. This was kind of a paparazzi picture of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, and then the caption underneath was Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, friends of Ernesto Colnago, with absolutely no explanation or context or any reference to Colnago bikes, which I thought was rather wonderful. A little note that I thereafter.
A little note that that I quite liked about that gold-plated bike was that Colnago actually had to make another one for Pope John Paul II because he preferred riding a flat-barred bike. That was the one he actually rode around on. So the gold one's back in the Colnago Museum. So a nice little footnote there. I also quite like the idea of the Vatican Press Office kind of dealing with, you know, general Vatican media business, and then suddenly getting a deluge of calls or inquiries from the cycling press about a bike that they've listed on for sale.
Okay, chaps, well, we're all rounded up back to the present day, although we're going to stay in reflective review mode. We had Arrivé, of course, at the weekend, our first Arrivé episode. There'll be more of those after the biggest classics over the coming weeks. It's going to be a busy few weeks, but we are going to talk a bit more about Milan-San Remo. We're going to get the microscope out. I said at the weekend that this is a race that has to be analysed with a microscope, not a telescope. We're going to maybe talk about micro and macro aspects of Milan-San Remo, the Milan-San Remo that we saw at the weekend, the Classicissima. Was it a Classicissima? Was it classic edition? I'm not really sure. What do you think, Rob Hatch?
Well, the key to the enjoyment always in San Remo is the anticipation, isn't it? Especially now watching it from kilometre zero, the day where all roads lead to Via Roma. But it all happened so quickly, and I guess it's what we like and what we hate about it at the same time, because it's so difficult to decipher. Everything happens so quickly. There's a lot of things that we don't know that happened at the time. You mentioned Filippo Ganna's mechanical earlier on. During the live broadcast, I have no idea what happened to him. I also was struggling to track Jasper Philipps. I mentioned him on the Cipressa. We mentioned him on the pod.
I wasn't even looking for him. At one point, in the sprint,
I have to admit, I wasn't either. And then suddenly he's there on the right-hand side. And I'm like, wow, you know, followed the wheels fantastically well. Was it a classic? I'm holding fire on that. I think it was a superb win for the team that won Albertine de Koenig. And I think there was a nice story in that Tadej Pogacar turned up wanting to win. It's difficult not to like that, isn't it? Not to enjoy how he tries to race. And I think even his rivals in the cold light of day, you know, once the dust has settled, would probably enjoy how he races because it turns more attention on the event. And I think that Mathieu van der Poel probably changed the result of the race, even though he didn't win it, on two occasions. So let's go to the top of the Poggio. You've got Pogacar attacking there for the second time, which is a bit of a surprise because it sort of looked like the hostilities were done with 200-300 metres to go. He went again. Everyone sort of almost hesitated. If they hesitate 2 or 3 more seconds, Pogacar probably wins Milano-San Remo. But van der Poel blasts across the gap. They all follow and things sort of sort themselves out on the descent again. And then down the bottom, you have Sobrero, who's looking like he's going to be the most unlikely San Remo winner in a long, long time. He then is caught by Pidcock. Pidcock, you think, wow, has he snapped the elastic as well? Sort of looks like he has. And then again, like a rocket, the world champion comes across the gap, drags everyone in, and the sprint's launched. And that part of the race was pulsating. It was confusion, as all the best San Remo wins, I think, are when they come down the bottom of the Poggio. But was it a classic? I think the jury's still out.
Richard, what did you make of
that? I think all of Rob's summary there probably took place sort of a longer period of time than the actual like real events, because everything happens so quickly, doesn't it, in that final 10 minutes, where it's almost like you want to slow it down to sort of 0.75 pace and just see what's going on and have a little bit more time to just analyze the consequences or the potential consequences of that. But that's the beauty of it, is that it's so rapid and it's so quick and it changes so rapidly that you don't really have that time to reflect or really think about what's happening at a given point. And what is it, the most sort of exciting moment of the cycling season is the sort of cliche, isn't it? I mean, I've started wearing one of these Whoop body trackers that, you know, measures your heart rate. I was going into like a high stress, high heart rate zone just from watching that. You know, it detected it. It didn't tell me that I was doing some sort of physical activity, but it wasn't far off what you would get from like a, you know, elevated heart rate. Anyway, I don't know whether it was a classic or not. Maybe is there a bit of perhaps a reluctance to call a race, a San Remo, a classic when a sprinter wins it? Is that sort of an element of a slight, you know, maybe not quite the ending that we hoped for.
It was the modus operandi for the race for a long, long time, wasn't it? And I don't think... I'm certainly not calling it a bunch sprint. It was a small group for me that came to the line. Last time
it was a small group. It was 12 riders, wasn't it?
When last time we had a bunch sprint was when Arnaud Démare won. I think that was 2016?
15.
And I think I ended up looking up at the weekend in preparation for the commentary how many bunch sprints there have been in the last few years. Of course, none since then. But in the 10 years previous... or prior, I should say, to Démare winning, six of the ten editions were bunch sprints.
And the decade before that, there were even more, yeah. Mm.
So I think it certainly wasn't a bunch sprint, but won by a sprinter who's more than a sprinter. Let's give him his dues, because Jasper Philipsen can climb. He showed that at the Tour last year. And, you know, probably opens up a debate about what a sprinter is nowadays, because I think, you know, it's different now, isn't it? Certainly than it was even 10 years ago.
Yeah, and the Poggio is really about raw watts. The Poggio itself is a kind of bunch sprint, you could argue. Obviously, you know, an 85-kilo rider is probably not going to get over the Poggio, but someone who can sort of put out 800,000, 900,000 watts. I mean, it would take that probably to break the elastic. Well, it might take 800 watts over several seconds. But I think it really is fascinating. Well, it leaves us with a fascinating question, and you know, I feel as though we're doing Philipsen a bit of a disservice by zeroing in on Pogacar, and we sort of zeroed in on him in Arrivé as well. But this question of, to use the words that I used in Arrivé, how he can bottle lightning in the future, I think is a really fascinating one, because it's going to be a really difficult needle to thread. And there was a few conflicting comments from Pogacar himself, I think, both before and after the race, about how they were going to do it, or how they might try to return and do it again, and either tweak things or completely rethink their strategy. Maybe there were also various pundits that weighed in about whether the single Poggio attack is the modus operandi that they should favour, or whether this idea of a very difficult Cipressa, maybe that, you know, this mythical, now mythical 9-minute Cipressa, is it possible? I saw yesterday people talking about Pogacar's training ride before San Remo itself. I don't know whether it was on Thursday when I think he did 9:12, but that may well have been motor paced. I think it was motor paced. Is that the way forward? If it is the way forward, does that mean he's going to go over on his own? Does he need a satellite rider in the valley on the Aurelia between the Cipressa and the Poggio? Rob, before I just ask you about this, I think it is worth hearing again, repeating, for those who didn't hear it, my short interview with Mark Hirschi at the finish line on Saturday, because he came in for some criticism. Some people suggested that he was missing in action to a certain extent on the Poggio, and UAE's approach generally to the Poggio, and well, their organisation on the Cipressa in particular, came in for some criticism as well. So let's hear what Mark Hirschi said about how it had gone.
Yeah, I tried to pull after the Cipressa. Normally I was planned to go to Poggio, but it was so hard, so we had nobody left. And then the final, I didn't know exactly. I just hear he was third. I mean, it's super hard to make the difference here. It's a long race, but the climbs are fast. So at the end, it's what it is.
Tell me something, the team principals, the guys from the car, were they satisfied at the end with third place?
I mean, I didn't know exactly what happened in front, because the radio is not working when you're behind. But for sure we give all, and we tried, that they tried. And it didn't work out, so we have to be happy.
Mark, we heard about this plan for a 9-minute Cipressa. It was 9:26. Was this a real plan? Was this something that you were definitely going to try and execute?
For sure, we know, like, you see the group are small. I think if you go 9:30 or smaller, already with Formula, I think we went super fast 2 years ago. It was like 30 riders, the same like this year. So, yeah, we tried to go as hard as possible with Diego and Isaac. Yeah, it's not easy, because you need to be in front. Everybody wants to be in front. And yeah, we try to make it as hard as possible, but still the climb is, I think, 36K average. So it's hard to make the difference against the big guys.
And was the hope that Tadej would be on his own on the top of the Cipressa, or just to take a small group away and, you know, maybe without Philipsen and those guys in it?
Yes, we just want to go hard to hurt other guys. So they have some lactate before Poggio. Yes, because it was never the plan to go Cipressa alone because it's too far.
Tadej said it was just very easy before you got to the Capi, and maybe too easy.
Yeah, I mean, for us, yeah, it was not super hard. At the break, when the start, they slow down, so they were riding smart. And then also for us was, we needed all the guys to make the race hard, so we could not pull too hard and waste one guy.
Rob, here she there saying, normally I was planned to go to the Poggio, but it was so hard. And he also said, we tried to go as fast as possible with Diego and Isaac del Toro. Diego Lisi was not there, was he?
There were several riders missing. There's a couple of things here. I think we were expecting, after the comments from Machin about this 9-minute Cipressa that you were talking about, we were expecting the big team and almost the mountain train for those 5 and a bit kilometres up the Cipressa. I was talking to Adam Blythe at the weekend, who I was with commentating, and he reckoned they made a mistake by trying to make it hard on the Capi before that and maybe wasting a bit of energy. Mm. And if you look at how it went and how it developed, I think Adam was right, because they get to the bottom of the Cipressa and suddenly they're bullied out the way. They're raced out the way by the rouleurs from the other teams. Mm. UAE Emirates picked a climbing team for this. Mm. They didn't really have a Nils Pollitt or anybody like that, or an Oliveira to get them in there and get the train set up. And there were only two riders on the front from UAE that get to the bottom of the Cipressa. Three then had to come up, and they had sort of half a team riding, and it took them a kilometre and a half to get organised. In terms of, you know, you think that he could go on his own. I don't think he can go on his own on the Aureli after that. It's too long, isn't it?
Can I just interrupt you a moment just to go a bit macro about what you say about rouleurs there and about Pollitt? A lot of people pointed this out, that Pollitt wasn't at San Remo. They could have done with a Nils Pollitt. I've thought this about their recruitment for a while, and also their selection of tour teams. And you know, maybe this is a bit unfair, but if you think about the people that manage that team, Giannetti and Machin, they've always managed teams that have been Grand Tour teams, and they've been climbing teams. Sornier Deval is the team that, for good or ill, they're most readily associated with. And I feel that they have neglected the rouleur department a little bit in recent years. And that applies to their Tour de France team as well. And okay, they've got Pollitt this year, who will make a difference. But exactly what you said, they picked a team of climbers for a race that's not really a climber's race.
Well, if you think as well, a couple of riders left, Gibbons and Trentino, would have been fantastic for that job, maybe. Mm. I think Pollitt is a fantastic bit of recruitment. I think the Oliveira brothers are pretty good at doing the job that they do. They do have riders, but yeah, when it comes to picking the team, I think that maybe that's an area department that could be thought about. I mean, I'm not going to say here and improve, because, you know, I'm not a director sportif. They obviously know a heck of a lot more than I do on that front. It's an observation that things maybe are worth thinking about there.
And hey, Ernesto Colnago makes their bikes, and he's a friend of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. So
it's not Mission Impossible, is it?
No.
I think to go back to that, I mean, you look at the way that UAE ride the Grand Tours, and they don't dominate or control the race in the way that Visma Lisa bike do these days.
We'll be in big trouble for that. rightly so. You know, rightly so.
They're more... You know, they're more like a kind of, they pick their moments, and they tend to sort of detonate the race at small moments, rather than have this sort of iron fist over the race. And I think in some ways, if they were going to dictate San Remo enough to make it as likely as possible for Pogacar to win, then they would need to have that sort of controlling approach to it, which just isn't in the UAE's DNA, I don't think.
Yeah, it's funny. They don't, in spite of being the richest team in the world, we think, and officially, according to the rankings, the number one team in the world, they don't have the same aura of, this kind of domineering aura that Team Sky used to have and the Jumbo-Visma have now. And part of it, you know, is when you go to races, and journalists who go to races watch, observe UAE, and by most accounts, it's a pretty fun place to be. There are a lot of smiles, there's a lot of sort of joking and laughing. Pogacar is, he's a bit of a ringleader leader of some of that as far as the riders are concerned, but also the staff. It's reputed to be a pretty nice place to work, and it's not the kind of stern, poker-faced environment that we've sometimes seen in teams that have dominated.
We've heard that from Adam Yates as well at the start of the season. He gave a great interview, and he, you know, because he's a nice guy, I think I've said this before on the podcast, he was at pains not to slag off his former employers at Ineos, but he did heavily hint that he was allowed a little bit more freedom. It wasn't quite as oppressive in terms of training and planning, and he was certainly enjoying it more at UAE Emirates.
Chaps, I wanted to ask you about something else that's passed, I wouldn't say unnoticed at the weekend, but I thought it was very significant. Tadej Pogacar, in an interview with L'Equipe before the race, so on Saturday, said explicitly, for the first time that I can remember anyway, that he wants to be the best rider of all time. Now, this struck me because it's not really in character for Pogacar to, you know, make declarations of intent or even to talk in terms of his legacy. He's a bit young to be talking about legacy. But I thought this was interesting, and I thought about it again yesterday watching the first stage of the Volta a Catalunya, where Nick Schultz, a rider who is very well liked in the peloton, and I think it's kind of known in the peloton that Nick Schultz has been knocking on the door for a long time, and he's one of these guys who probably, it's a bit of a consensus in the peloton that he deserved a win at some point, and he's not going to win 30 more races in his career. Anyway, Tadej Pogacar, okay, UAE had ridden for him yesterday, and they'd invested a lot of resources in him winning the stage yesterday, but Pogacar shot out of the peloton with 200-300 meters to go, and he was trying to catch Schultz, and very nearly did catch Schultz. And I put the two things together, that yesterday in Catalunya and the comment that Pogacar had made, and I said to myself, this guy is the wannabe aspiring new cannibal. In fact, someone else told me last week that, you know what the nickname for Pogacar is in the Merckx family? Little Eddie. Had you heard that before?
Never.
They call him
that.
Little Eddie, apparently. Interesting.
That's
though.
A compliment, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it is a compliment, but you're thinking about San Remo, thinking about his future in San Remo and all the other things that he wants to win. He also said in the same interview that he wants to win a third Tour de France, and then he'll switch his focus to some of the other things he hasn't won yet, like the World Road Race Championship. But Rob and Richard, what do you make of those comments in particular?
They surprise me, I think, as they surprise you, just because they're not exactly in character. I never doubted that, you know, I think anybody goes, does anything, wants to be the best that they are. No,
I mean, just remembered, he also said it with Michael Matthews and Urshka, his girlfriend, in the car. The interview was on sort of loudspeaker in the car as they drove to Milan San Remo. And he said it with them presumably listening.
Yeah, but then again, they're best of friends, aren't they? So I don't think it's anything that will be a secret to Michael Matthews or obviously his partner who are there in the car. But they're surprised, I think, for those who don't know.
You told me earlier today you want to be the best commentator of all time. I heard you say that.
Of course. Anyway, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to achieve it. But no, I mean, we'll look back to last year because he didn't manage to win a Grand Tour last year, but he finished the year as number one in the world. And you can argue about the UCI point system and all that sort of stuff. But I think if anybody said that, they wouldn't be shocked or surprised, because to me he is, because of this all narrative, all conquering, all sort of riding on all fronts, trying to win everything attitude. And you know, I don't think really we might not be surprised, or we might be surprised by those declarations, those comments, but we probably shouldn't be, because you know he is winning sort of everything that you know, apart from San Remo for now. But he's getting better, isn't he? Fifth, fourth, third in the last 3 years, he's getting there with just about every race he turns his hand to.
And I think as well, every race he turns his hand to, he is the talking point. He's got that star quality, which is, it's not to say that winning is no longer important to him, because it is and it should be. But the fact that he was the story, the talking point of Milan San Remo very much beforehand, but also sort of afterwards, you know, we're talking about him now rather than Jasper Philipsen. And I think something that I've maybe noticed a bit more from Pogacar this year is that sort of playfulness maybe willingness to sort of embrace the entertainment side of cycling a little bit. You're seeing a little bit more of his character, and I don't think that there's going to be like a the sort of need to win that maybe Big Eddie Merckx had. You know, he was voracious, and that was why he got his nickname the Cannibal, because it, you know, there was no sort of deference to other riders, or you know, he would just gobble up races. And so I think part of Pogacar's mindset, I think, here, or maybe even if it's not conscious, but the way he's seems to be approaching it, is to be the greatest, not, or to try to be the greatest in terms of his profile and the entertainment that he brings to cycling, to the sport, and I guess what he does for the sport as a whole. That's notable when you compare him to Jonas Vingegaard, for example, who is much more performance results driven, I think, than perhaps his public persona, or, you know, that side of things.
I think as well, part of that is generational. You know, you go back to what you touched on before when you were talking about the comments from the United States and what have you. I think people can be themselves more, can enjoy themselves more, and society's changed, generally views changed. Different generations have different approaches to things. I think that goes a long way into explaining that sort of phenomenon. Because I was talking to Mathieu van der Poel yesterday, and he was talking about the entertainment factor as well, and the fact that he wanted
to
win too.
That's a big name to drop.
Sorry.
Go on.
In an interview, by the way, you know, this is an official setting. It wasn't, you know, there was no WhatsApping going on or anything like that.
You're allowed to drop names on the second point. We do all the time. Rob, you talk about different generations there, how different generations view things, perceive things. That sounds like a good point at which to go back in time. Go back to San Remo, go back to the weekend, but we're going to go further back in time. And we are going to set out on an investigation that I undertook last week. This was as a result of something I'd heard, a murmur about the San Remo route and how it had maybe changed in a way that not everyone will have been aware of before last week. So as I said, we're going to go back in time. I'm going to take you back to last Friday, just before 11 o'clock. And, let's join me, shall we, on the Via Matteotti in Sanremo. Milano, Sanremo, Eve in Sanremo. Today I'm off on a bit of a special mission, but at the moment I'm just before 11 o'clock, so I'm allowed a cappuccino. I'm just enjoying my cappuccino and brioche croissant in the historic centre of Sanremo, the Via Matteotti, which is just sort of a parallel road to the Via Roma. As you can hear, it's very lively, in fact, on Sanremo Eve. It's a beautiful pedestrian street. You can hear a street performer in the background, the locals getting their morning coffee as well. So that's where I currently am, Via Matteotti, just outside the Ariston Theatre. But talking of Sanremo landmarks, I am about to visit another one, and you're going to find out what it is, exactly where it is, just a moment. I have to hire a bike first to get there. There'll be some light physical exertion involved, and there's a bit of a mystery that needs to be solved at the end of it all. So let's get on our way and reveal a few more details as we go.
Praticamente se sta 3 ore sono 19 euro.
Ho capito.
2 ore 14 o 8 da scalare.
So I'm on my way, hire a bike. I'm now heading out of San Remo from west to east on the Lungomare Italo Calvino, this bike path that was built a few years ago, dedicated to Italo Calvino, one of the most famous Italian novelists of the 20th century. Wrote books like Cosmic Comics, The Eve on a Winter's Night, A Traveller, and Barone Rampante. We talked about that in the Giro last year. I can't remember what it's called in English, something Baron. Anyway, this bike path
it's quite something. It held the first stage, you might remember, of the 2015 Giro d'Italia, a team time trial, if I'm not mistaken, which was quite controversial at the time because it's pretty narrow, but it's very beautiful, extremely beautiful. And I'm not going to reveal exactly where I'm going yet. Just passing, in fact, on my left-hand side, Albert Nobel's old gaff. Swedish scientist gave his name to the Nobel Prize, or whose name was given to the Nobel Prize, spent the last years of his life here. However, that is not our final destination. More will be revealed in a few kilometres. Left turn off the Lungomare, the bike path, Italo Calvino. Hard left, then I'm just heading up the Via Aurelia, which is the coast road now that Milan San Remo takes, and I can see a sign, Poggio, 4 kilometres, and it's a right turn, and I'm going to be taking that right turn. Lower slopes, or mid slopes of the Poggio. I'm not going after any records today on my city bike, on my Torpado. I have a feeling pretty good considering I've not been on a bike for a while. Heart rate is steady, sort of 140, and passed a few quite serious looking cats on their carbon fibre bikes, so I don't know, maybe I might give Strava a look at the end of this. I'm Strava in it, just see how I stack up, if not against Giorgio Furlan, his, I don't know if he's still got the record, 1994, some of the modern day stars in the world. Poggio di San Remo. I've made it. I'm just coming into the village now, the little hamlet of Poggio. Any second, I'll see the famous phone box that signals, well, the end of the climb, the end of the last major exertion of San Remo, apart from the descent and the 2 kilometres into the finish on Via Roma, of course. But, plot twist, where's the phone box gone? I see no phone box in the Piazza della Libertà, and I'm feigning surprise here because I knew the phone box had gone. Someone told me a few months ago, and this is what I wanted to investigate today, and I'm going to investigate that now. I'm going to ask some people up here in Poggio, and there are a few shops. Well, there's a bar, the Monte Calvo bar, like a lot of famous climbs in cycling. This, I suspect, is the fountain of all knowledge about the Poggio and maybe even the phone box itself. So I'm going to go into the Monte Calvo bar and see if anyone there knows what's happened to the phone box. After that, there's a pharmacy next door to the Monte Calvo bar. I might try there. Greengrocers over the road and a post office as well. But I think the Monte Calvo needs to be first port of call.
Io sono un giornalista, sono qua per la corsa da Sanremo. Volevo chiedere, qualcuno sa che fine ha fatto la cabina telefonica?
E l'ha portata via? Sei già il secondo che me lo chiede.
Sì, ma diversi qualche mese fa, no? Sarà stato quest'anno.
Sarà stato, quando l'ho tolto. Le hanno tolte tutte le cabine,
capito? Ho letto un articolo, sì, dovevano togliere tutte, però qualcuno è rimasto, mi sa.
Slightly less enlightening and fruitful than I'd hoped. It was busy, pretty no-nonsense sort of place. The Monte Calvo. Monte Calvo, of course, means Bald Mountain, so it's sort of named or a namesake of the Mont Ventoux, or Mont Ventoux's nickname anyway. Was told there might be some people later who sort of have encyclopedic knowledge about the race itself and could tell me some stuff about that. I said that's not really what I was here for. I was interested in the phone box, and well, what I was told about that was quite simply was that it was taken out a few months ago, and that was about it. They were slightly sort of mystified as to why it had taken on this mythical status, at least for observers of the Milan San Remo, the bike race. And it is part of a Team Telecom Italia's campaign to kind of uproot and replace in some cases with these sort of newfangled internet type portal phone boxes all across Italy. And that is about it. But as I said, it's a pretty no-nonsense place, the Monte Calvo. And there's a sign, there was a sign on the counter, a piece of cardboard with scrawled in permanent marker, "You'll eat what you're given." And that's the menu today on the eve of Milano Sanremo in the Monte Calvo bar. Next stop, possibly, I'm thinking the greengrocer's next. Ah, ho capito. Stavo facendo un'indagine sulla cabina telefonica che è sparita.
E allora è già capitato un giornalista francese.
Ieri?
Mi ha chiesto la stessa cosa.
Sì, allora.
Praticamente è in progetto una piazza qua. Una piazza con delle biciclette disegnate così.
Ah, ho capito.
E l'hanno tolta.
Ma questo diversi mesi fa, mi sa, l'anno scorso, fine dell'anno scorso.
È già qualche mese che l'hanno tolta.
E lei si chiama? Solo per...
Bottini, Fabio.
Bottini, grazie. Sì. Fabio. Grazie Fabio, prego. Grazie, buona giornata.
Ali, buona giornata.
Okay, so finally some semblance of information there from Fabio Bottini. You heard him there. That was in the convenience store greengrocers up here, opposite the Monte Calvo bar, opposite where the phone box was. And that was Fabio saying that effectively the council here has a plan to build some kind of monument to Milan Sanremo. In this little piazzetta car park with bikes, and he doesn't know what else, statue, some kind of monument. I said to him that it struck me that one thing which they could possibly do and might be appropriate would be, well, to reinstate the phone box and make that part of the monument. I don't know, Tadej Pogacar getting dressed, a sort of wax work of Tadej Pogacar, getting a Superman cape on in the phone box might be nice. Something similar. You've probably got better suggestions. I don't know if that is the end, that signals the end of my investigation.
Siamo un missile, ossia me.
Di scesa, però.
Tira via 35. Da Trueia.
Ciao, l'ultima amica.
Martinez, se corre Martinez, però l'ho detto che è leggero, devo ascoltare anche lui perché...
potremmo aspettare in 100 anni che non vincerà Martinez, secondo me uno di 50 kg. And there it did end, sort of, with a group of Milanese fans, cyclotourists outside the Monte Calvo bar, assuring me that Lenny Martinez would win Milan Sanremo, despite the fact he wasn't riding. Or did it really end there? Well, no, because I still had something to do. And much in the same way that both the ladies in the Monte Calvo bar and Fabio Bottini in the convenience store in Poggio told me that my colleagues from L'Equipe, or French journalists, had the same idea as me, and they'd been making inquiries the day before my visit. The Telecom Italia communications department told me I wasn't the first person to call them, asking for some sort of explanation or context.
Pronto?
Buongiorno, cercavo la signora Bolletta, per favore, Simona.
Se mi lascio il suo recapito la faccio richiamare.
Allora, domanda relativa alle cabine telefoniche.
Okay.
L'Equipe's piece came out on the morning of the race and was entitled "The End of a World." The author was our friend and colleague Alex Rus. And sure enough, Tim had told him pretty much exactly what they would tell me. Namely, there was a resolution passed last May, AGCOM 98/23 cons, that removed the obligation for universal coverage or universal service of public telephones in Italy. Consequently, a lot of phone boxes were being removed or recycled in respect of the heritage of those phone boxes, they said. Some were also being replaced by new generation multi-service portals. Simona also said that their record suggested the Poggio phone box had been installed at some point in the mid-1970s, but they couldn't be more specific than that. I, of course, then tried to analyse old footage from that era, and to be honest, struggled to get a definitive answer. The first edition I could find with the phone box definitely, incontrovertibly in situ that I could see, that I could find, was the 1981 race won by Fons de Wolf, my research about Italian phone box in general has been a bit more fruitful. Found out, for example, that the first one ever built in Italy was in Milan's Piazza San Babila. It was inaugurated on February the 10th, 1952. 16,000 of them, just over, were still in use in Italy at last count last summer, although that number will now come down pretty quickly because there's a recognition that they're simply not needed anymore. It's been reported in Italy that between 2018 and 2021, on average, every public telephone was used 118 times a year, so approximately once every 3 days. Given that only a few hundred people live in Poggio, I'd be willing to wager that its phone box was used even less than that. So all pretty sad, and well, maybe we're pretty sad for caring or being interested in such things. I suppose the biggest surprise for me in all of this has been that the mythology around something so prosaic and banal grew so quickly. It reminds me of a bit of some of what we said last year about Italian food with the Professor Alberto Grandi, who talked to us about Eric Hobsbawm and his theories about the invention of tradition, this idea of history legitimizing the way we continue to act in the present, cementing the cohesion of a group, in this case, crusty old cycling people like us. But as ever, Alex Rousse probably said it or wrote it best in L'Equipe. I quote, "They tried to reassure us the phone box was torn down, but everything was recycled in accordance with environmental regulations. As though imagining its parts transformed into straws in fizzy drinks was going to comfort us. Worlds, or rather epochs, colliding as we're bereaved of a sacred and memorable place, an ordinary and even derisory object which was nonetheless a beloved fixture in our lives. The Poggio phone box has disappeared, yet it'll remain in our memory. And in 20 years, when we talk about it, people will take us for sentimental fools, nostalgic for a time that's flown away." Well, there we go, chaps. No more phone box on the Poggio, at least for the moment, unless it's reinstated, unless someone is receptive to my suggestion that it should be reinstalled, reinstated with a waxwork of Tadej Pogacar in it. There were much more tasteful suggestions that I heard over the weekend. You sometimes get these phone boxes now. I can't remember, is it in the UK or certainly in Germany as well? You get these phone boxes that are sort of book, what do you call them? Book library.
I've seen one of those
book exchanges
in Modena. Actually, I've seen one of those in Modena. One of the first ones I ever saw about a decade ago, and I thought it was a wonderful idea.
Yeah, one a sort of a library, a museum with cycling books in there would be one idea.
It wasn't a phone box. It was a bus stop. But there's one in the Shetland Islands that's quite famous. I was cycling through there last summer, and it's got a fancy dress. Sort of, it has a theme every year, and you can go in it and shelter from the wind. And the last year when I was there with a friend, it was like a nautical theme. So you could sort of go and dress up as sailors and pirates and, you know, ponder a globe and just in a phone box. So maybe something like that, you know, dress up as, well, whatever you want.
It got us thinking though, didn't it, Richard, maybe about not. Can we think of anything comparable to the Sanremo, the now defunct, the now lamented Sanremo phone box, anything of that nature, anything else on the roots of Grand Tours? I mean, this is very cycling, isn't it? We sort of do mythologize, fetishize these banal kind of everyday objects in some cases, places. I try to think about other sports as well. Difficult to think of something similar, something that has been mythologized to the same extent in such a short period of time as the San Remo phone box. I was thinking about the road on the road hole on the 17th hole at St Andrews in golf. Robert?
Bolton Road when you're walking down to Ewood Park?
Oh, God.
I would say something that this time of year that springs out to me certainly, and again, this is a personal thing because it depends on what you've noticed. But Ronde van Vlaanderen Straat is the one of the roads that is crisscrossed a million times in all of the Flemish cobbled races.
Yeah, last week I was a little bit under the weather and found myself on this kind of really unnecessarily deep dive to try and find a roundabout in Flanders that I couldn't find it in the end, but I do remember it, and I'm sure it's on the Tour of Flanders route. It's in somewhere like Ronse or Brakel. But Belgium's got quite a few of these sculptures, ornaments, creations in the centre of roundabouts. Have you noticed this? Quite odd and striking. And anyway, somewhere, I couldn't find it. So if a listener knows exactly where this is, I'm going to sort of crowdsource the exact location of this cone of chips. It's a giant cone of chips on a roundabout, which is sort of a great summary of Flanders. And I remember driving past it on umpteen occasions, obviously not well enough to remember exactly where it was, but there's a huge, you know, it's sort of talking 10, 15 metres tall cone of chips somewhere in that Flemish Ardennes heartland. But there's something about it's making the mundane and the everyday significant that I think cycling is good at. Because you might have your mural or your famous piece of street art or some sort of, you know, I think of like Father Time at Lourdes, you know, and the cricket. But they're very much part of the infrastructure, and they're there, and they're sort of part of that establishment. The things that cycling clings onto are banal and everyday, and they have no significance really, except from this weird clinging onto them that we as cycling fans have. It's quite hard to think of others for the monuments. I did, in one of the ones that came to mind for Liège was just that kind of carpet of Philippe Gilbert graffiti, you know, that's there. Well, it's there all year round, isn't it now? Fill, all the way up La Redoute, which means nothing, but it's sort of a fixture. And it, again, is sort of fever dream deep dive. Do you want to know the first year that someone wrote Philippe Gilbert on La Redoute?
Before 2004. I think he made his debut in Liège in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, I would say 99.
Yeah, 98. Yeah.
Wow.
So he was 15 in 98, but obviously still making enough of a name for himself in Remouchon or Away, isn't it? His hometown, just down there at the bottom of La Redoute. And there's also in Roubaix, there's a motorway bridge, if you know the one I mean. It's just by Orchy. So it's like a footbridge going over the motorway.
Pont-Gibus, yeah.
No, not the Pont-Gibus, because that's where the old railway thing, right? That goes, the cobbles go through it. But there's a motorway bridge that goes over the road, over the motorway. But it's where that famous picture, every year there's a picture of kind of, like we were talking about, the dusty, heat hazy cobbles and the peloton snaking away over the Orchy sector. And it's where all the photographers quite often go, because you get this kind of slightly elevated view of what is a very flat part of the world. And for me, at least, that whenever I see that footbridge, you see it on the motorway when you're driving down to Roubaix, and that signifies that you're right next to the cobbles there. And yeah, I don't know. Can you think of any for Lombardy or for...
You've got the chapel at the top of the... But I mean, again, rather like the one I mentioned before on the Van Vlaanderen Straat, sort of a construct. It's not really natural. Mm. I've got one in mind for this weekend to finish off on. You ready? Right on the finish line of Gent-Wevelgem, if you've ever been there, you know what I'm talking about. It's Snooker Palace Barbara, and it's a cafe, a snooker hall, that does very average coffee and a nice plate of chips, okay. But it's right on the corner, and it's got a mural.
I thought you were going to say something else there. Another kind of establishment that sort of have proliferated in Belgium over the decades.
It is a much more innocent establishment than that.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we should end part two. Well, chaps, we've dealt with the past, the recent past, the distant past. We've dealt with some of the present, and now we're going to move forward to the future and the near future, because we are about to head into, well, the most intense period of the season in, certainly in Belgium. We've got the Cobble Classics on the horizon. And they've already started. We had Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, we had Kuurne Brussels Kuurne, but these are the big ones. Are they not, Rob Hatch? Because you'll be working on them.
The
sixth edition is on Friday. And, well, our appetite, as I said, has already been whetted by Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. We've already seen soon the sort of outlines of what might be some trends and storylines and subplots in the Cobbled Classics. Richard, you were at Paris-Nice with me. You were certainly there for the first few days, and I know that you were talking to riders even then, a couple of weeks ago now, about the Cobbled Classics and what we had in store, what we'd already seen. Luke Durbridge is a rider who has done a lot of Cobbled Classics over the years. I don't know how many times he's lined up in Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, but it's a lot. He, of course, rides for Team Jayco Alula, and well, you spoke to him for a little preview of the Cobbled Classics that we've got coming. Let's hear a little bit of that conversation, shall we?
So you've raced the opening weekend, and yesterday kind of felt a bit like mini opening classic-y. There were bits in there, weren't there, that looked a bit like that.
Yeah.
What are the sort of takeaways from this year in terms of how the classics have been raced and some of the trends or some of the things you've noticed?
Well, I mean, every year it's as solid as the next, but I guess what I would notice is that, you know, you haven't had all the favourites at the one race yet. They've all showed great form in every race they've done. You know, Walt van Aert won Kerner. Vanderpoel hasn't even turned up yet. Pogacar went 80k solo. Mads Pedersen's been winning, you know, left, right, and centre beforehand, but didn't go to opening weekend. Look, so I think it's all, you know, building up to this amazing race when they eventually meet in E3 or Gent-Wevelgem or something like that. Look, it's going to be sort of race for, I think there's going to be two races out there. Teams that maybe don't have one of the big five, I'd say, will be more opportunistic. The breaks are going to be so hotly contested. We saw that last year as well, taking 90k for breakaways to go on the classics, because that's the only opportunity you got. Like, for someone like myself, if I can get in the breakaway and I can miss the first couple of big efforts from the, you know, the big five, and they come to you, and then you're in the final and you could be up a top 10 there. And we saw that last year. Guys that are in the breakaway are getting rewarded. They're going deep into these finals. So, yeah, these breakaways are going to be insane, which I think is just going to also play into the hands of the big five, because the harder the race is, the better for them. So, yeah, look, I really feel like you're going to see some of the fastest classic races we've ever seen this year, purely because of this tactic. You've got to maybe have 10 teams that want to get in the breakaway and five teams that... It doesn't really matter if the brake's there or not. They're just going to go and catch them, and that's it. So, yeah, it's not a negative way of looking at it, but I think that's just the way it is, and it just means we're going to be in for one hell of a classic as a spectacle. It's going to be a hell of a classic for a rider. But, yeah, hopefully we get some nice weather.
I guess, like, what we saw at the opening weekend is that those teams that have some of those big favourites, the big stars, are equally capable of putting guys in the breakaway and stacking that up as well. So do you think maybe there might be a few more kind of... Not quite favourites in that second tier, guys that are going to get a victory, or do you think it's still going to ultimately benefit those big stars?
Yeah, look, I think there's probably Jumbo is probably the only team I'd say that has five guys that, you know, all can win the race. You know what I mean? There's a lot of them a bit more clear leaders. Maybe Trek's got a few bit of depth. Not many teams have that much depth. So yeah, I could see, you know, in an E3 or a Flanders or something like that, you know, a Tratnik, a Jorgensen, Thijs Benoot, the list goes on. Yeah, Laporte. Not saying Laporte's second tier. None of them are second tier riders. I would never say that. But you know, if they go early, it was like the same problem Quickstep had years ago. It was the first guy to attack would get the win. You know, Yves Lampaert would go. Boonen would be on ice, and Stierbar would be on ice, and Gilbert would be on ice, because Yves Lampaert was up there winning the bike race. So I could see that happening also. So it's really, that's been the race going to open up early. It means the guys, you know, in that second tier are going to open up real early, because as soon as they go up the road, they're not going to get chased by the strongest team, which is Jumbo. So
are there any riders who've kind of made a bit of a name for themselves this season, who've made you think, oh, where's this guy come from? Or like, he's going well, he might be due a good ride, you know, maybe a rider that you wouldn't have watched before or noticed before, perhaps?
Oh, I mean, I think the Tom Schoon's progression has been amazing. I mean, last year you really saw him take the step up as a classic rider, and then we saw what he did in Strada, we saw what he did in the World Championships the year before last year. Yeah, I reckon he's going to have an amazing classic season. Generally, when it starts this good, it generally doesn't go down from there. And I think if you start well, you will see more results from him coming forward.
How about yourself?
Yeah, well, look, I've been there for a while now, and I know how these races go. And look, I've been training hard. I didn't do the Aussie Summer this year, and I'm fresher than I normally have been at this point in the season. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to, you know, using Paris-Nice as a bit of a build and get up the road in one of those breakaways, and then when they come to me, then I can play with the big boys. So, yeah, like I always dream of doing that. And been a few years since I've been in the final of the Classics, so like to get back up there.
So, Richard, that was you chatting to Luke Durbridge a couple of weeks ago, talking about, well, a few of the things we might see over the coming weeks. Mentioned Matteo Jorgensen there. That, of course, was before Matteo Jorgensen won Paris-Nice. I think Matteo Jorgensen last week has been in Nice, and he has been continuing his build-up to the Cobble Classics. I know he went riding a couple of days ago with our good friend Joe Dombrowski, newly retired Joe Dombrowski. Jorgensen will be certainly a rider to watch over the next few weeks. Tom Schoens as well got an honourable mention there as one of the revelations. He's a bit old to be a revelation, and he's been a very strong rider for some time, but he's certainly moved up. He's moved up a notch this year. But Tom Schoens of Little Trek, he got a mention from Luke Durbridge there as well, Richard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jorgensen going to E3, isn't he? I think that's the first outing we'll see of Paris-Nice winner Matteo Jorgensen back on the cobbles. It's sort of like a shuffling of like various different favourites, isn't it? E3's got Van der Poel and Wout van Aert. Wavell Games got Van der Poel, but no Van Aert. There's Jasper Philipsen and Tim Melia's going. And then we've also got what's now Classic Bruges de Panne, the one-day races for men and women. For the men's, you've got Philipsen and Melia going to that one, so sort of Soudal versus Alpecin. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, these are often, they turn out kind of interesting little precursors and previews for Tour of Flanders, but equally entertaining races in their own right. E3 especially, sort of mini Flanders. I've always liked that one in particular. And they have fixed the Paterberg. Did you see there was some consternation in Belgium that they might have to take the Paterberg out of the some of the races this year because there was a landslide at the bottom of it?
How can you have a landslide on the Paterberg?
Right, apparently right at the bottom or on the road leading into it, wasn't it? On the corner or something like that?
Yeah, just on the corner. You know, it's that right turn. So they come barreling down basically from the top of the Quarmont, don't they? Or the... Is that the Ronde van
Vlaanderen? A landslide sounds as though it might be over-egging things, like a slight trickle down the side, no?
Yeah, well, come on, it's spring in Belgium, in Flanders, isn't it? You've got to over-egg it, Daniel. I mean, it was a perilous landslide, this cascade of rocks.
Sure, wasn't it? Yeah, an avalanche of monstrous proportions.
Could have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all right in saying the Paterberg was sort of constructed especially, well, not especially for the Cobble Classics, but there's a farm there, isn't there? That farmhouse that goes, you know, and then they built the road. Mm. Anyway, that has been, as of a couple of days ago, that's been shored up and the concrete is setting as we speak, I believe. So, it's not quite the Alder Quarmont Paterberg finale that you get in the Ronde, but it's pretty close, isn't it, E3, to like a mini Flanders. So I think that's going to give us a lot of indications there for what we're going to see in, what, a week later, isn't it, Tour of Flanders?
Yeah, as its own identity, just like the word identity, as its own identity. Just like a lot of the races around there, the Tijenberg's pretty important. You know, you go over the Stationsberg, very close to that as well. Wonderful sort of names that always get us excited. Lots of crowds, lots of people will be there, despite the fact that it's going to be a Friday afternoon. And it's Flanders without the distance, let's be honest. It's got the same sort of start list. Van der Poel will be there with
Van Aert. Is anyone missing? I couldn't really see any notable absentees on the start list.
I'm sure there will be somebody, because it's difficult, isn't it, to glance down. But I mean, most of the big hitters will be there. I know that the Visma Lisa bike, or half of the Visma Lisa bike team, is coming down from altitude for that. So let's see how the likes of Tratnik and Benoit and Van Aert are. Jorgensen, you mentioned, coming from a brilliant Paris-Nice. Van der Poel's going to be racing there just for the second time this season after he started at the weekend. Bettiol is there. You've got Oyer Lascano, who's been up getting ready as well himself. He's done an altitude camp at some point this spring too. And the Lidl Trek team that's really strong that we saw at the weekend as well. There's a few teams, you know, like Ineos Grenadiers, who've been very quiet this year. What are they going to sort to do as well? There's six, all sorts of different top riders.
Yeah, there. Only six names on their provisional lineup so far, Ineos Grenadiers. Just one team, well, Rob and I were scrolling through the start list. Groupama FDJ, no Lawrence Pithy on the start list. We didn't mention him in Arrivé. What a good Milan San Remo he rode until, well, very high up on the podium. I think he finished 15th in the end. But I must admit, I haven't got any information about this. Now, I'm not really familiar with what his race program was supposed to be, but it strikes me as he has the kind of physique which would suggest he's got a future in the Cobble Classics.
I wonder if they are thinking more about Sunday's race with him.
That is certainly a possibility. Rob, Mathieu van der Poel, we've talked a lot about his role in Jasper Philipsen's victory in Milan-San Remo at the weekend. I did say, and you did remind us that you were, you spent an afternoon, I think, in his company yesterday, and that was at Canyon. And was that part of the unveiling, the announcement of this multi-mega contract, 10 years on Canyon bikes. And we heard from me earlier in San Remo on the Torpedo hire bike. I haven't got a 10-year contract with Torpedo, fortunately, I'm glad to say, because it was an absolute dud. Mathieu van der Poel, 10 years, how is this going to work? Because it sounds to me as though that has tied him to, well, at the moment there are two World Tour teams, aren't there, ride Canyon bikes. So he's either going to be riding for Alpecin de Koenig or Movistar for the next 10 years, unless, you know, they change sponsors, which is possible. How is this going to work? I can't really get my head around this contract.
Well, I mean, the first part, as a rider, I'm obviously signed 10 years to link himself to the brand. The brand he obviously enjoys. I think we had a list of 163 victories since he started riding Canyon bikes, including mountain bike, road and cyclocross. Of course, for a brand, he's an absolute superstar, isn't he? Because he rides across different disciplines. He helps the brand, you know, be interested in selling a lot of different bikes and developing as well. So, you know, somebody at the top of the game can help a brand develop technologically. And I think that has always been a big part of that particular brand's identity, hasn't it? The development and things like that. And so I think Van der Poel's keen to being on that. In terms of him continuing to ride on the road, well, at the same time, he's inked a five-year deal with his team, Alpecin de Koenig, the team that's owned by the Rodolf brothers in Belgium. That's where he's achieved all of his success. And I guess if it ain't broke, don't fix it, no? He's going well, and I imagine that the financial terms must have been acceptable to him, otherwise he wouldn't have signed.
Yeah, yeah. But how? I'm just curious as to how it works. You know, is it Canyon going to be paying? I mean, I presume that if one was to get into the weeds of who pays what, who contributes what to the budget of the team, Alpecin de Koenig, you would find that Canyon do contribute a substantial amount of money. But are they in year eight? It's year seven and year eight. If this contract is worth millions a year, well, his contract with his trade team is certainly going to be worth over $1 million a year. Who is currently down to pay what in sort of year seven and year eight?
I don't think would be privy to that information apart from the people who've signed the deal. Just like in any sort of pro sports contract and things like that. But, you know, as a brand, he's sort of joining names like LeBron James, Manuel Neuer, Valérie Bottas as sort of big ambassadors for the brand. And I think it, you know, this is part of, I think you mentioned Sagan earlier with Specialized. I think we're increasingly economically seeing sports stars linked to brands. You've seen in football as well, you know, who signed for which team might be influenced by the brands as well. Just the economic landscape, I think, of sport is changing and has been changing for a long time, and maybe we're the ones who perhaps need to look at it a little less traditionally on that front.
Do you think he's worried that the Pope's on a Colnago?
I don't think he's short odds for Edri Press on Friday.
Do you know what? The Pope, I mentioned the Pope, that reminds me. I think was it 2 days ago? Or maybe it might have been yesterday. You know Stefano Locchio, who is sort of the route designer. He's
the biggest Inter Milan fan in the world.
Yeah, he's kind of the route designer of the Giro d'Italia, or one of the route designers, and was a sprinter, a very successful sprinter in his day. His nickname was the Pope, Il Papa.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. So there you go, Van der Poel. Any other pearls of wisdom from Van der Poel?
Plenty, actually. And there's an interview that's coming out on YouTube, on the Canyon YouTube soon. I had a sit down. I was really privileged to be invited to interview him for a few people who were in the Canyon family who worked there. And he was on really good form. He talked about his entertaining. He talked about really wanting to win things. And he did confirm to us that one of his objectives in, you know, firstly, the first 5 years he signed with the team and the 10 years he signed with the brand is to go for that Eric de Vlaming Cyclocross World Championship record. He's got 6 rainbow jerseys already there. 7 is the record. And so I think we haven't seen the last of him on the cross field, which is good, because there was talk about whether he was going to, you know, not ride as much cross or anything like that. So he's got plenty to aim for. He seemed in good mood and he seemed in a really happy place, surrounded by a lot of people who were happy to be involved with him in the brand as well. It was a real feel-good event.
Any talk, Rob, of the sort of beginnings of a mullet going on there with Van der Poel?
I mean, it was more than beginnings. He was sporting a cracking mullet. It was like 1983 all over again.
White shorts, white world champ skin suit, mullet.
Adam Blythe was loving that at the weekend. You know, Luke Platt going for the white skin suit as well. That was the most exciting thing of the race for our mate Adam. He loved it.
The mullet, the Bundesliga haircut, I think they call it in Denmark, because a lot of German footballers had it. In Germany, it's called the Vorkuhila. Vorne kurz, like forward, to at the front, short, and hinter, lang, and long at the back. Vorkuhila, or the Bundesliga haircut. Both slightly more, I don't know, more compelling than mullet as a name. Anyway, chaps, on that really undignified note, I think we should probably round up today's podcast. Unless anyone's got any other business they would like to share.
No, the sun's shining. Can we go for some lunch now?
Let's do that, Rob. Whose humble abode or not so humble abode will we visit next week? Oh, that might be a bit of a struggle, a bit of a problem. My address book has been exhausted by the last 2 episodes. Richard, can't remember whether you'll be back next week, but if not next week, then certainly very soon. You are. And Rob, you'll be back soon as well. So until then, it's goodbye from me.
Gracias.
Goodbye. Thanks.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.